Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Joining me today, I've got Matt Cole, who's a Managing Director at SBJ Capital, and Jordan Margolin, who's Head of Business Development at VSS Capital. Today, we'll be talking about how the two of them approach deal sourcing, market trends and shifts, and the impact they have had on their respective deal pipelines. We're also going to touch on which strategies they employ to help their portfolio companies achieve growth targets, the impact of longer hold periods, and their predictions around deal activity. So just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with all of that housekeeping out of the way, Matt, why don't you kick us off? As Managing Director at SBJ Capital, introduce yourself and your firm to the listeners and explain your role and your investment strategies. And I'll just say, I know SBJ prides itself on your unique investment approach, so feel free to touch on that as well.
Yeah, that's great, Todd. Thanks so much for having me on and really great to chat with you today. So SBJ Capital, we're a low mid-market private equity fund investing from our second fund. I was part of the founding team, initially actually on the investment side, and then ultimately migrated over to business development, which I lead currently. We invest in family and founder-owned businesses, so we are a first institutional capital investor focused on the consumer and business services industries broadly, as well as a few areas of healthcare. We like to think of ourselves as a strategic capital partner. We work with our partner companies to improve operations and accelerate growth. And really, you know, when it comes to our unique approach, I think ultimately what it comes down to is, you know, where can we be the right capital partner where our experience, our potential to add value, and our relationships really are the right fit for the business at the stage that it's in and the opportunities ahead for it.
All right, Matt. Well, BDO certainly values our relationship with your firm. So I know you're a busy man. Appreciate you joining today. Jordan, over to you as Head of Business Development at BSS Capital Partners. Perhaps you can share a little bit about yourself, your firm, and we'd also love to learn about your role and hear about your fund's investment approach. And also, if you don't mind, feel free to expand on BSS's value creation tactics for your lower middle market portcos.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be here with you and Matt. VSS Capital Partners is a New York-based private investment firm. Been around for a while, since the 1980s. Actually started out in 1981 as a media-focused investment bank. So we were doing a lot of cable, broadcast, television deals. Really knew the market. So in 1987, started our first buyout fund focused on media. Fast forward to 2005, started to see the writing on the wall a little bit. Folks weren't reading newspapers as much. The media landscape was changing. And we shifted our strategy to what it is today. So fast forward to today, we're now on our eighth fund, which is a $530 million vehicle. And similar to SBJ, we focus on founder-owned, owner-operated businesses, trying to be first institutional capital, typically writing anywhere from $20 to $50 million checks, no longer really touching media. We predominantly spend time in three high-level verticals: healthcare, business services, and education. I would say where we're a little bit different than some other firms is just the flexible nature of our capital strategy. So we can deploy capital in both control and non-control situations. And we're often backing existing management on their next stage of growth. So not typically dropping in an operating partner, which some other private equity firms prefer to do. We like to support management and their vision of the company. Having said that, happy to say we just completed our 100th platform investment, which is a great deal for the firm. But we've also done over 600 add-on acquisitions. So I think that's a big piece of the growth strategy, especially in the lower middle market. Can we find companies that complement these platform investments, whether it's bringing them into a new market, expanding on their capabilities, or really just bringing, you know, other talented and smart individuals to the table as thought leaders.
Well, congrats on the 100th platform. That's quite the achievement for any firm. And we've certainly been very active with VSS Capital as well. So we appreciate the relationship and you joining us here today, Jordan. So guys, this is episode 47 of the podcast I've been hosting for years now. And I think there's only been one other episode where I had a couple BD professionals on. So being a BD professional myself, I'm excited to be coming back to the topic of how you guys are thinking about everything that you do in the PE sector. So I'd love for our listeners really to get a sense of your approach to sourcing deals and which industries are really top of mind for you right now. Matt, why don't we go back to you?
Yeah, no, happy to do it. Todd, congrats to you on the 47th episode. That's no small feat. So very, very impressive. How we're sourcing deals, and I'm sure Jordan shares this view a bit, there's many legs to the stool, which is to say in the low mid market, it's a huge landscape. There's a ton of M&A advisors. It's a huge market from just a sheer number of companies. Even if you're industry focused, like we both are, just the sheer volume is actually really, really kind of staggering. And it leads to different strategies than when you talk to biz dev focused guys at, you know, funds that are further up market, certainly, you know, up at the mega funds or something like that. And, you know, the volume is still marketed deals, you know, auction processes, working with M&A advisors. And so, you know, you have to employ strategies where you can both develop good, solid relationships with people that understand your firm's focus, understand your capabilities, understand where you can be the best potential capital partner for a business. But at the same time, also spend some time on sort of the one-to-many types of biz dev origination marketing efforts, whether that's email or social or other sort of creative ideas. I suspect Jordan would say the same. It's literally thousands of people that you're trying to keep up with, or at least be on the radar for, you know, so that you might be kind of part of their process when they're thinking about going to market with the business. So that's the marketed side. But then there's all those other ways that we're trying to develop relationships with companies that are relevant to sectors that we're particularly interested in or have experience in. And we'll do that to a certain extent with, you know, some of our operating advisors or company execs that we've worked with or going to trade shows, which is all to say that it's a whole separate, you know, quote unquote, leg of the stool. And you have to think about, you know, how you allocate time to each. These days, there's more technology tools than there's ever been to try to accomplish both of those. Frankly, sometimes you just have to decide which tools you have the time for. There's more than any of us can manage on our own. So you have to think about which ones are most effective, most relevant to your particular strategy. And then just to the last part of your question, in terms of sectors that we are focused on, you know, as a fund, we are broadly interested in consumer B2B and areas of healthcare. I think the subsectors of interest are always evolving, frankly. We'll spend time internally, you know, having strategy discussions about where we see trends, what we're most excited about. You know, after spending time on one deal, would we use that experience to think about related businesses or sectors that we want to focus on? And we've certainly done that. In this environment, we spend a lot of time on commercial and residential services. We have one platform in that sector and think we have a good story as to why we'd be a good partner for others. Anything food and food related, we've made a number of investments in the food sector over the years and continue to be very interested in making more. And then the TIC sector, if you will, test, inspect, and certification, that's another one where we're spending a bit of time and developing more relationships and looking to potentially find opportunities.
Well, it was a recurring theme in your answer, Matt. You touched on a bunch of things, but relationships. And I feel the same way. My colleagues kind of look at me and say, how do you keep all these balls in the air, right? And it's building relationships and reputation. So I appreciate all that input. So Jordan, how about you? How has VSS been sourcing deals in the current market? Perhaps you can touch on any sectors you're particularly focused on right now.
Yeah, I think to Matt's point, obviously a ton of individuals to stay in front of. So I think with that, in the industry at large, you've seen over the past couple of years, a big focused on building out business development and origination specific teams at Shouts. So at VSS, we actually have three individuals solely focused on origination and sourcing. Having said that, I think there's a nice symbiotic relationship with the investment team. So we've taken the approach over the past few years now on definitely trying to be a bit more proactive as opposed to reactive when it comes to finding investment opportunities. So all of the principals and VPs on our investment team are actually expected to own, you know, one or two investment theses per year. And then working in conjunction with the business development team, we'll go out and, you know, use those technology resources to map out the market, identify the relevant bankers or relevant sponsors that have been active in that sector, and then really firm up an internal perspective on that specific industry. We can then take that a step further and then generate some relevant content that can be sent to founders directly. I think there's a lot of noise in the market, and I'm sure Matt's seen this, you know, response rates on emails and cold outreach have definitely gone down in the past couple of years, just given the amount of activity that's out there and the amount of firms that are getting contacted. So what we've done is tried to stand out from that noise by creating relevant content that helps out these founders. In terms of industries that we're spending time, you know, we definitely high level healthcare, business services, education. I think on the healthcare front, you know, we've been fairly active across the physician practice management landscape in recent years. We're definitely starting to spend more time now in pharma services and tech enabled payer services. On the business services front, we have two active theses there, one in outsourced insurance services, so specifically premium audit services and managed repair networks, as well as government IT services. Finally, on the education front, continuing to spend time in K-12 focused content and curriculum businesses, but as of late, I've recently spent more time in the continuing education landscape as well. So think continuing medical education, continuing legal education, even some of your hard skills, training and certification. There's definitely a shortage of, you know, HVAC professionals, plumbers, electricians, et cetera. And then we really like the tailwinds there and, you know, what we deem as lifelong learning.
I love the part, Jordan, about collaboration with your colleagues on the investment thesis and that kind of stuff. I mean, I do that day to day at BDO with various practices, whether it's our Q of E guys or the operational value creation folks or just the audit and tax folks. We try to, you know, co-cover relationships, and we're always trying to find way to add value. So I love that. So let's talk about referral sources for a little bit. I know that's critical to my job, and certainly I'd imagine for both of you. Jordan, why don't we start with you? Have you found any referral sources to be particularly helpful in your deal sourcing process?
Definitely. I mean, as we discussed before, you know, not going to ignore the bankers and the M&A advisors and business brokers out there. They're obviously working hand in hand with a lot of these founder-owned businesses. The way we work with those groups, which I think today is over 1,000, believe it or not, is we tier those relationships, really tier 1 through 4, and try to kind of really map out the importance of those relationships based on the quality and quality of deal flow, the relevancy of where these folks are spending time from an industry perspective. Having said that, there are a lot of ancillary sources of deal flow that we like to tap into. So think lawyers, wealth managers, accountants, consultants, essentially groups that are going to be, you know, working with a founder or a family-owned business and maybe privy to a transaction prior to that company getting engaged with a sell side investment bank. You know, another piece of the puzzle, which has definitely grown in recent years, is just the emergence of independent sponsors. So groups that are really looking to raise capital on a deal by deal basis. You know, oftentimes these groups have a quote unquote proprietary deal in hand. You know, they've leveraged their own network to get something that's off market. We love getting involved in these situations, especially given our flexible mandate where we can provide both the debt and the equity to the independent sponsor. And we've successfully backed 2 independent sponsors now on new platform investments. Finally, you know, I would just point out that our current portfolio companies and the management teams there can also be a great referral source. They have their own networks, you know, oftentimes in their own industry, but can know folks in other industries as well. And more than anything, you know, they can really quantify and qualify how supportive of a partner we've been and can really speak from experience. So I think that recommendation from a group that has been a partner with us previously can go a long way when trying to drum up new business.
All right. Well, Jordan, thanks for all that. I'm glad you mentioned the accounting firms. I was worried they weren't going to be in your list, but appreciate that. And I've definitely seen a lot of our clients spending time with independent sponsors. So that is a legit area of focus. Matt, how about you? What has SBJ found any success stories in working with referral sources?
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess what I'm saying, rather than repeat too much of what Jordan said, because I would certainly echo all of those points and all of the areas where you can find really great referral sources and a lot of the same types of relationships that Jordan mentioned. I guess what I'd say, just to add on to it, is, you know, we try to think about it sort of as an approach and from a cultural perspective, meaning the way we conduct ourselves with, you know, key partners like the accounting firms that we work with, or the attorneys or board members that we interact with, or wherever or whoever we're interacting with, sort of within the M&A ecosystem, which can feel like a small world at the same time as it's a huge market that we're investing in. You know, by thinking about just being thoughtful, I know you like to use the phrase, and I totally agree, paying it forward where we can and being a good partner, you create trusted referral relationships as you go. And if you keep doing that and you keep doing it well, you keep building more and more of those relationships over time, ultimately you're going to be successful. And I think that's the approach we try to take in our sourcing, in our investing, in our portfolio management, and everything that we do. And ultimately it benefits the firm over the long term. At the end of the day, it's still people-oriented business. For all the transactions that we work on, for all the technology tools that we use, and Jordan mentioned the emails that we're all sort of drowning in. Yep. You got to make those personal connections, and you got to do it in a way that builds trust with people over time. And if you do, you'll be successful.
Yeah. All relationships. And yes, Matt, you're right. I love to call myself a pay it forward networker. And I don't take any of the relationships for granted. I feel like every day I've got to earn at bats for transaction and portfolio and fund work. So certainly dedicated to that. So let's move on to kind of post-investment support. And Jordan, I'll come to you first. Once a investment is made, what's your process for supporting your portcos, really to ensure that they achieve the growth rates or growth targets, really?
Yeah, maybe I'll frame this out just in two buckets. So more of the inorganic growth strategy and then more kind of internal organic value creation.
Yeah, perfect.
So to my point before, M&A, especially in our end of the market, is always going to be a big piece of the strategy. I think initially when we make an investment, we're constantly trying to frame out, you know, how fragmented is this market? Are there opportunities for add-ons to grow the business? However, you know, I think we've seen this in the past couple of years, integration of these add-on acquisitions is extremely important. You know, folks want to be able to see that this is truly a platform and that there's cross-selling taking place and best practices are being shared. Companies are on the same ERP system. You really need to have that visibility of same store growth while growing from an inorganic perspective. I think on the organic side and thinking about value creation, we really think about it in terms of people, process, and technology. So on the people front, you know, are there any gaps on the management team or board that need to be filled? I think, and I'm sure Matt can attest to this, often some of the initial hires are in finance and accounting, increasing investment to the sales and marketing team. And then we can leverage our network to add industry advisors to the board or serve as more of a strategic partner to these companies. On the process front, you know, I think we're very involved with management. I think with the advent of Zoom, probably more so now than ever, don't really need to hop on a plane anymore to be with management. So we're speaking to management on a more consistent basis. Of course, we're involved from a strategy perspective during quarterly board meetings and annual board meetings. At the end of the day, though, you know, we do still see management as running the day-to-day of the business, and we could be more so involved in the bigger high-level decision-making. Finally, on the technology side, constantly trying to improve our company's tech stacks, you know, whether that's moving things over from QuickBooks to NetSuite, evaluating how we can optimize processes with the new AI tools that are coming out, or even from an acquisition perspective, can we make acquisitions that maybe the company's a bit smaller, but have a truly differentiated piece of technology that can then be dropped into our platform investment and leverage, you know, a bigger customer base. On that note as well, setting up, you know, stronger KPIs and reporting mechanisms for the company to adhere to.
Yeah. All right. Appreciate all those perspectives, Jordan. Matt, kind of same topic to you. Any role you have in supporting your portcos post-investment to help them meet their growth objectives?
For sure. And, you know, it's a key part of obviously any PE fund, and SBJ is certainly very, very focused on the post-investment value add. I think the important thing, and for us and others, is to be thinking about that pre-close. We spend a lot of time thinking about how can we add value to this business before we, you know, really even get too far down the path of, you know, potentially making investment. We need to have conviction that, you know, we have sort of the playbook, the resources, or the ability to go find those resources that would ultimately be really valuable to help that business wherever it's at. So, you know, just first and foremost, we're thinking about it really from the beginning. And we take a pretty human capital focused approach. You know, we're a relatively small fund in the grand scheme of private equity, but we're employing some of the same strategies that funds much further up market are doing when it comes to portfolio management and value add. So, you know, we started building our operating partner team with a head of human capital, a head of growth strategy. Our head of human capital is a great partner when it comes to portfolio management because, you know, at the outset, we're working with the management team to think about where are the gaps, what resources are needed, what can we bring to bear? And that's across all functions, whether that's finance and IT, which is almost always an area for an opportunity for improvement with low mid-market businesses, certain elements of the growth strategy, both organic and inorganic. And thinking about, you know, who we can bring in, whether that's, you know, full-time from an advisory capacity, consulting, project-based, or otherwise. And, you know, a big part of it is that what I've seen, and I think a lot of people that invest in, you know, family and founder-owned businesses in this segment of the market have seen is that, you know, it's not the business owner or the management team doesn't know where a lot of those opportunities are or recognize that, you know, they could invest more in their, you know, finance and IT systems to help the business be a little bit more data driven than they have been historically. But it's also all their risk. It's all their capital. And so as a first institutional capital partner, one of the biggest things we can do is that we are bringing those resources and helping them, you know, invest in the business in a way where it's not all their money. It's not all their risk. And we can sort of formulate that plan of post-close, where do we go from here and what do we prioritize and where do we try to go with the business? And we can do it as that capital partner. So that's not, you know, it's not all on them anymore. And, you know, it's something we talk about up front in diligence. It's sort of the question of, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and resources weren't an issue, where would you invest? And honestly, I think, you know, 8 out of 10 times, 9 out of 10 times, you know, we'd agree. And they know that business as well as anyone. And, you know, we're there to sort of make those things happen and bring the capital, the resources, the people to ultimately take the business to the next phase of growth.
Lots of insight there for our listeners. I really appreciate both of you without giving away the secret sauce. Certainly demonstrated that there's a lot that goes into meeting those growth objectives. So I appreciate you guys sharing so much. Let's talk about the longer holding periods we've been seeing. We actually discussed this a ton on the last episode of our podcast, but I wanted to see how your respective funds are managing what seems to be a new reality for the PE model. Matt, I'm going to stay with you. Why don't you kick us off here?
Yeah, well, now I'm regretting not listening to your last episode. So I didn't have the answer all canned up and ready to go. But without that, I'll actually say, agreed, we're in an environment right now where hold periods are longer and you know, everyone's focused on it, whether it's the funds, the LPs, the service providers, et cetera. You know, it's something that everyone's thinking about and experiencing. But I would comment and say, you know, it wasn't that long ago, you know, 2021 or otherwise, where, you know, that it wasn't necessarily the case. People were experiencing record deal volume. Hold periods were a little bit shorter as a result. The machine was moving pretty quickly. And then obviously we've been through a series of events and market conditions post-COVID, be it inflation or interest rates or supply chain challenges, you know, that created all kinds of both opportunities and headwinds for a lot of different businesses. And when you're going through just market changes like that of that magnitude, it has a huge effect on a lot of businesses. And, you know, as investors, when you're trying to manage through, you know, such a dynamic environment, and maybe you're not hitting your growth objectives or the types of returns that you think you might be able to generate at exit, it does slow things down. And so we're definitely in that environment, but all you can really do is keep doing the same things, focus on, you know, efficiency and growth in your businesses, react to the market as it exists. And, you know, if I had to guess another year or two from now, who knows, we might be talking about a different set of circumstances with regards to the hold period. But right now you sort of buckle down and focus on what you're good at and, you know, try to create value in your portfolio companies.
All right. Let's put a pause on that forecast because I will come back to you. Jordan, same topic. Perhaps you can share how your firm is managing the longer hold periods.
I think to Matt's point, you know, value creation, definitely top of mind, I think. Right. Firms are trying to focus on creating value as opposed to just relying on, you know, financial engineering to bring about returns. What's interesting is our latest platform investment, number 100, it's a business called Treya Partners, which is actually capitalizing on this trend. So they're a management consulting firm and essentially specialize in procurement, value creation, strategic sourcing, and some spend management advisory services for mostly mid-market private equity portfolio companies. So in some ways, you know, these longer hold periods could actually create an investment opportunity for private equity firms that go after companies selling into the PE ecosystem. A little unrelated, I do think something we've seen and have definitely mulled over ourselves is, you know, dividend recaps definitely being more prominent in the market. Obviously, there's a lot of private credit dry powder out there. You know, lenders have shown really an increased willingness to participate in dividend recapitalizations and other leverage refinancings. And this, you know, really allows a private equity firm to raise some additional debt and then use, you know, that cash to essentially pay some distributions to LPs and get some capital back. So we're going to continue to monitor that. And I think too, you know, for portfolio companies, a dividend recap can be a little bit of a dry run, so to speak, for an intentional sales process, kind of gets management teams prepared with the types of questions they might need to answer and kind of get their wheels turning a little bit.
All right. Appreciate that, Jordan. I'm actually going to stay with you for the next topic. On a related note, though we've talked about it, you're both more involved in deal origination. You're probably thinking ahead to an eventual exit when targeting new companies. And I think we touched on some of this during the meeting your growth objectives topic. But many think that exit activity will pick up in the coming months. Just curious, which paths to exit, if any, do you predict will dominate the landscape? So again, Jordan, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, I mean, looking at the market as a whole, you know, I think deal activity in general has definitely remained a bit muted throughout 2024. You know, I imagine Matt can probably attest to this as well, but I think where we play in the lower end of the market with founder-owned businesses probably hasn't been as affected as, you know, sponsor-to-sponsor trades. So we would expect, you know, that to potentially pick up in the rest of Q4 and into Q1 2025. Having said that, I think corporations are going to remain, you know, active buyers in this market, especially those that have cash on hand and then can use M&A to build some capacity and gain market share. You know, maybe not as relevant to our end of the market, but, you know, larger private equity assets may start exploring the public markets a bit more through IPOs as a mean for exit. IPO activity definitely subdued in 2023, but definitely starting to see a little bit of an uptick in 24 and, you know, would expect that to potentially continue into 2025.
Yeah, Matt, same to you. Kind of what strategies do you think we'll see on the deals front in the next couple months?
Yeah, I mean, first, definitely agree with Jordan. I think low mid-market, family founder-owned business, you know, that has remained relatively consistent in terms of deal volume, and I expect it will continue to do so. Now, whether or not the types of deals come to market that are a good fit for any given fund, you know, ours included, you know, that always varies, and everyone has their own experience there. But I do think that segment will continue on. I think the other thing we've seen, and Jordan touched on this, is that the sponsor-to-sponsor market obviously slowed down. But we keep hearing about sort of this, you know, rolling expectation of, you know, increased pitch activity, expectation that, you know, in the next quarter, some of that sponsor-backed deal activity is going to pick up. And that's been going on for quite a while, and obviously hasn't picked up to the extent that a lot of people thought, certainly over the past 12 to 18 months. I do suspect that will change, you know, for a variety of reasons, and certainly hearing from a lot of bankers in the market that they share that expectation. In terms of, you know, the strategic acquirers and where they might play and how they might impact different processes and deal volume, I tend to think that's a really industry-specific dynamic. And, you know, I see some in certain areas that we invest in, you know, food as an example, where strategics at one point, you know, came way down market in terms of what they were interested in. You know, market conditions change. They tend to retreat back up. And there will continue to be sort of those cycles that different strategic buyers go through. And there's always sort of unique circumstances in each industry and how the strategics look at it. But nevertheless, I do think that core mid-market and, you know, further up market deal activity, we've been wrong before, but it does feel like that's set to start to ramp up, certainly going at the end of the year and into 2025.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, it's about time to wrap this up, sadly, because I am enjoying chatting with two BD guys. But I want to pose one more question to both of you. Every episode, I like to get a pulse check from our guests about what's to come, kind of the crystal ball opportunity. So we're a little over a month away from the presidential election. We just saw a big rate cut from the Fed. There's potential for a lot to change throughout the remainder of 2024 and the beginning of 2025. So I'm going to ask both of you, I know we just talked about past the exit, but what are your wider predictions for private equity for the next 6 months? And Matt, I promised you I'd come back to you on predictions. So why don't you kick us off?
Oh, man, it's tempting not to make predictions, especially when you tee it up in the context of an election. The no comment button is definitely tempting. But, you know, I don't know. I'm actually optimistic in general. That's the theme of where I'm at right now. Short of any unexpected real big impacts to the market, I do think deal volume is going to continue to ramp up. I'm optimistic about that. You know, we continue to see uncertainty around the consumer, but at the same time, a lot of resilience. So I think good businesses can continue to be successful in all the different markets that we're investing in. You know, we'll continue to see evolution in the PE market. The continuation vehicle segment has grown. I think that will continue to grow. I think that's interesting and has a lot of positive impacts on the exit environment and deal activity. I'm going to keep it short without making a whole lot of predictions and just say I'm optimistic for sort of market trends going into next year.
Fair enough. I'll take that. Jordan, why don't you close us out here? What are your thoughts for the next couple quarters?
Yeah, I think I agree with Matt in a lot of ways and have to be cautiously optimistic, right? I mean, if we were pessimistic, I don't think that would be helping anybody. But for good reason, though. You know, I do think an interesting dynamic might continue to play out for the remainder of Q4, where, you know, there's kind of these off-market, pseudo-banker-led fireside chats where maybe groups are speaking to four or five parties to gauge interest and get a feel for market appetite. But then you have the election and some uncertainty kind of hanging over. So I'd imagine those processes kick off, you know, in January of next year. But going back to my point before, I think having specific investment theses, letting the market know where you're interested and spending time kind of helps you get involved in those early conversations with groups prior to an official launch of a process. Definitely going to continue to keep an eye on the fundraising environment. That's been tough for private equity firms and probably won't change anytime soon, you know, especially for first-time funds and emerging managers. That's been a tougher fundraising cycle for them. And then outside of that, you know, maybe just one sector that I'd mention to keep an eye on outside of what I said before. And I think we've seen anything around critical infrastructure being really attractive. You know, you have aging infrastructure, priorities on sustainability and decarbonization, tighter regulations. All of this is leading to significant demand for infrastructure upkeep and renewal and upgrade. So I would keep an eye out for that sector to continue to remain active in the coming months here.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Guys, well, I'm just going to pile on with the optimism at this point. We're certainly very busy doing a lot of fund transaction and portco work. I always say our QFE practice is a good leading indicator, and I don't think we've ever been busier. A lot of buy and sell side work. So fingers crossed that the deal flow continues and even picks up in early 2025. But guys, that's a wrap. I want to thank you both for being here. I know you shared a lot of nuggets with the listeners. And again, Matt with SBJ and Jordan with VSS, both really appreciate and value our relationships with your firm. So again, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Todd. I really enjoyed it.
Likewise, really appreciate it, Todd.
All right, guys. To our listeners, thanks so much for listening. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.
Investment banking products and services within the United States are offered exclusively through BDO Capital Advisors, LLC, a separate legal entity, an affiliated company of BDO USA, LLP, a Delaware limited liability partnership, and national professional services firm. For more information, visit bdocap.com. Certain services may not be available to attest clients under the rules and regulations of public accounting. BDO Capital Advisors, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC.